So in any case, rather than continue with this introduction, I'll ask you to please welcome Lady Michelle Renou.
We'll test it.
All right.
Thank you. Friends in skepticism. Can you hear me fine? I have to say that I don't believe in anybody or anything 100%, and I don't recommend it. That's my comment on Mr. Steele. But I would like to give credit where credit is due. And I do have to acknowledge and give thanks to the three people who brought me here in the first place for the original conference. And that would be Dr. Tobin, Mr. Harvey Taylor, and Walter Muller. Now, I'd like to say about Walter Muller that I think he was trying to put on an artistic conference. And to his credit, he was trying to raise the standard of a conference. And I believe that is perhaps why he cancelled it, because he didn't feel that he could put on that particular conference somewhere else. Now, I think that had Dr. Tobin, been here, frankly, when he should have been here, at the last stages of a conference, when we all know that we have a very nasty enemy of free speech in those organizations, such as interfered with this one and interfered with the former conference and had it cancelled, one must be here if you're going to organize something. And I dare say, had he been here, he would not have had it cancelled. I like to think so in any case, because it must be said that to have gathered 360 people plus for a conference has never been done before. And whether it actually went ahead, which it didn't tragically, or not, nevertheless, it was an achievement, and I think those three gentlemen should be given credit for that particular achievement, though we may have other thoughts on the matter besides. Now, I have to say, apropos of this conference, I can't tell you how proud I am to be standing before this title here. I much admire Mark Weber and his institute enormously, so I'm exceedingly proud to stand here, I have to say. Now, I will be talking about free speech battles in Britain. But before I do, I'd like to describe to you the points that I'd like to make along the way are to do with what we don't really have a proper title for. We've had doublespeak from Orwell. We've had from Lewis Carroll, contrarywise. And as a matter of fact, that's how I see the sort of doublespeak that we are constantly being given. I think we need a new coinage, and I think Joe Sobran will be the right man to give that new coinage. But for the moment, we're stuck with Alice in Wonderland. And my little story that I'm about to give you, in fact, rather revolves around this crazy world where you state one thing, but in fact the opposite is the case. And a perfect definition or example of this is diversity. We are told that diversity is what we celebrate. But how do we do this? What we do is we mass migrate the races from one area of the world to another where they don't belong. Fauna and flora belong in certain parts of the world. We flourish best in these parts. To mass migrate is to, in fact, undermine their diversity. We will not have the racial differences which are the pleasure of our different cultures. So, in fact, we have this peculiar contrary-wise speech, where we are expected to celebrate diversity, and in the doing of it, we undermine and do away with it. Pardon me. So, the first example, and what brought me to any understanding of what's been happening long time before I ever had any idea, I'm quite a newcomer to this field, was when I stumbled upon, by chance, the idea that tyranny was to give a choice. This was my first experience of what I call contrariwise. And it happened to do with Shakespeare, of all things. Nothing to do with World War II, nothing to do with the Holocaust. Neither of those things I'd been particularly interested in at all. But I had designed a knot garden for Shakespeare's Globe. Just briefly, though it's nothing to do with it, I'll just tell you that a knot garden is what I call the nub of Elizabethan thinking, because it's sort of like a piece of lace on the ground made out in box. And in between these patterned areas, special plants that were coming into Tudor England from abroad were being planted to celebrate them. But the knot actually is a description of Shakespearean thinking. When you gave a posy of flowers, you gave a coded message. Now, if you want to give a coded message, there's red roses. That's a coded message. But all the other messages, which were very much very important in the allegory of Shakespeare, they were lost. So I had designed this, and for that reason, I was on the advisory board of the rebuilding of Shakespeare's Globe on Bankside in London. And I had been asked if I would chair the fundraising, the major fundraising event of that year. Do you know, I can't remember whether it was 94 or 97, but it was from either 94 or 97 that I became aware of what we are aware of today. And how it happened was that I was asked if I would put together an evening that had already been partly decided, and you'll see soon how it becomes relevant. It was to be at a private house for 100 people. The ticket was going to be £200 to £500. Now, I don't know what that would be in dollars, but it's you know, you could expect vintage champagne and some caviar for that. So I wasn't going to sell or be prepared to sell what I call rubber chicken, because normally for these charity events, you're usually given chicken because most people will eat it and because it's cheap. And, of course, invariably, it's cooked like rubber. So I wasn't interested to be part of such a thing. So I said to the caterers, who are the top caterers in London, the Ivy, would they be able to give a choice in the main course? So I could tailor the evening somewhat to people. They could feel that they were being looked after in a special way, so it was a little bit elite in a way, I guess. And because I wanted the evening itself for everyone to feel that they were at and sharing something together. I rather like that idea. I don't particularly care for even attending myself at a charity event where you're sitting at a table, you might as well be in a restaurant. There's no sense of the experience together. So the Ivy suggested, well, Elizabethan feast, why not have suckling pig, sea bass, which is considered a glamorous fish in England, and a good vegetarian. So I thought, good, sounds very good, no chicken. Not that I have anything wrong with chicken, but, you know, I couldn't possibly sell the same thing that people were selling very cheaply for £500. So I took this to my 25-strong committee, which I called my coterie because I wanted it to have an intimate flavour to it. They were all hand-picked people of my own, and presented my menu. And one woman jumped to her feet, and I think hysteria is the correct description of her reaction. She said that no choice had ever been given before at a charity event, and that if I was going to insist upon a choice, that she would regard me as a tyrant, and that she would resign. So I was a little confused by this Orwellian kind of approach. So I said to her, well, you probably could make a philosophical argument that in my insisting upon giving a choice, I was being tyrannical. But in the normal course of events, a choice is not tyrannical. But we do begin now the Alice in Wonderland story that appears to be the way I've been living my life or experiencing it since then. So I pressed her to explain to me what it was that was troubling her. And after a little time, she said, well, you can't expect Muslims and Jews to sit at the table where others might opt for the pork. I said, well, why ever not? Table fellowship, after all, is not threatened. Anything that does threaten it seems to me to be particularly nothing, not really worthy of respect. And after all, people have their reasons for not eating meat, and there are many dietary reasons why people cannot eat, but normally it doesn't prevent anyone from sitting next to people. So my persistence started to worry the other 24 people in a way that I had never seen before. Her behavior was one thing, but the fear, the palpable fear of the other 24 people, that fascinated me. I said, we were talking about food and diet. And I said, we should have a social conscience. After all, we're running a public event to some extent, and that we should take into account the kind of things that we should be responsible for. We shouldn't concern ourselves with valuing something that gets in the way of table fellowship. Well, people started to say I was being anti-Semitic. Well, this rather took me aback, because I don't know that I'd ever heard this term since high school. And I'd never taken a lot of notice of it then. So it really struck me, the idea that I was talking about diet and food and having an Elizabethan event, and suddenly people were being very nervous and very, very anxious and talking about anti-Semitism. So to cut a long story short, the evening did go ahead as planned. We had the choice. It was hugely successful. I raised a lot of funds, and we actually built the wardrobe of robes room, and you can see the plaque on the wall if you go to the Shakespeare on Bankside. And people said to me, well, you won. And I said, well, you know, I didn't win. I lost three people to what I apparently have coined a new phrase without realizing it. I lost three people to what I call myth-addledom. And it got me very interested in this idea of people being frightened of nothing. To me, it did seem to be nothing that they were really frightened of, except the idea of somebody being tyrannical. Had the woman not given me the term, I wouldn't be standing here, perhaps. But she, in the old projection way, she projected upon me her own tyranny. She wanted that evening to respect, or be turned into, an evening where one was respecting one particular group of people. She was Jewish, she wasn't Muslim. One particular group of people's sensibilities, and that we were all to revere this, which struck me as being rather tyrannical. So, not too long after that, I had been invited to Bayreuth, to Wagner's festival in Germany, the opera festival, by the late Prince Peter Dragazi. His family had helped build Bayreuth. And whilst there, I saw a young Greek boy looking at this brochure, and it was about a symposium that was going to be held at the Netherlands University. And it was called, Was Wagner a Dangerous Artist? And lo and behold, it was to do with his anti-Semitism. So I thought, that's me, apparently. This apparently is the definition of me, so I must go along to see what it is I have in common with Richard Wagner. I had no idea I had anything in common with Richard Wagner. So I went along, and sure enough, I found the same peculiar fear. Here was a university where I thought one was fearless. I think the Hellenic core of our cultures is skepticism. That is the one thing that we really celebrate, that Judaism, for example, does not. But I'll come to that. So I expected at a university there would be no fear, no intellectual fear. So when I asked some questions about the matter, I found that people were drawing back. They said, well, Beck Messer, who's one of the characters in the Meistersinger, he's a bureaucrat. Like any bureaucrat, doesn't have to be Jewish. There was a character called Mima in the Ring, but he's like a troll, a Norwegian troll. He's not necessarily Jewish. So I couldn't get them to explain to me, though in Wagner's prose works, which I think are tremendous pieces of work, though fairly verbose, but they are magnificent pieces, where he is actually purging himself of a lot of material, I couldn't see there was any anti-Semitism, so to speak, in his, what he calls, his artworks, his operas. artworks of the future. So I couldn't get any response. I got no better response or no more rational response from a university symposium than I did from my little coterie. So it got me very interested. This fear that people had, this peculiar fear, that 60 years after the war and they couldn't discuss, well, Wagner, never mind 60 years after the war, Wagner, Hitler, was not born in Wagner's lifetime. And of course, the buck usually stops at Wagner, whereas I have come to understand that the buck very much stops at the Hebrew scriptures, that we keep looking at the effect and not at the cause. So I then started, thank you. So I then started eating McDonald's food. This was the big change in my life. I suddenly felt that I couldn't waste time shopping, cooking, doing anything. I just wanted to refuel quickly and read like a maniac. I read everything I could on anyone who'd written about Wagner's anti-Semitism in particular. And then I started, because it was relevant when Harvey mentioned my career, because from babyhood I have been what I call an advertising tool of persuasion. I have been a photographic model since near birth, certainly in the first 6 months of my life and up until the present. And since teenagehood, I've acted in television commercials internationally. So that's why I say I have been a tool of persuasion myself lifelong, and I'm still my commercials. There is one shown here, and there's for vitamins, there's one shown in Switzerland, Austria, and Italy at the moment. So I'm still currently an advertising tool. And I look, therefore, at Wagner's mythology and Judaism from an advertising point of view, which apparently is rather unusual. And so I looked at the very term anti-Semitism. And after I'd read everybody's views on what anti-Semitism was, both for and against, not that there's too much anti-Gentile understanding of the notion of anti-Semitism. I mean, one has to come first. Anti-Gentilism has to come before anti-Semitism, but I didn't get to read too many comments. And you have to bear in mind that I knew nothing of Mark Weber, Paul Fromm, never heard of David Irving, never heard of revisionism. I hadn't heard of anything. You know. So all I had heard of was the anti-Semitism of Wagner. So I thought my view was totally my own, because I did seem to have a very different view to anybody else that I'd managed to read. And I'd read really, as I say, fanatically for 3 years and put on a lot of weight in the process. Now, where was I? I say I'm an open book, but too many footnotes, so I'm apt to lose my place. Now, what was I telling you? The term anti-Semitism, yes. Now, I've come to the conclusion the term anti-Semitism itself is a propaganda tool, probably invented by Jews, in order to persuade themselves and non-Jews alike that the behavior, Judaic behavior or Jewish behavior as we understand it, is genetic, because you're using a genetic term. Semitic is a genetic term. Now, I believe that there is nothing particularly Semitic in so-called Jewish or Judaic-oriented behavior. To my mind, it's mimetic. That means it's mimed or copied after birth. If you're born into that kind of circumstance, given the kind of formula that is involved in the Judaic identity, you very rapidly develop those symptoms, as I would describe them. You behave in the specified way, because there is a hugely seductive formula in Judaism that people actually wish to make and prove it the case. If you're given to understand that you are incredibly special, in the Talmud we understand that hitting a Jew is like hitting God, that a rabbi debating God wins. If you have this incredibly narcissistic notion of your importance, you are inclined to want to prove it. It's attractive. We do get a tremendous wave now of the gifts of the Jews in our radio programs and so on and so on. It's a highly persuasive, and naturally people want to prove it. So it's a very motivating driving force, this particular formula. So that I say a child raised under those kind of precepts is much more inclined to succeed materially because those are the values than a child who is not reared in that. So I say it's mimetic rather than genetic. Anyway, that was my thesis. So I actually wrote a monograph at the end of all this eating of McDonald's and those wonderful chocolate thick shakes and such, and all this enormous amount of reading that I did. My children find me, they often say to me, grow up, get a proper job, and stop mixing with weirdies. So unfortunately, I didn't do that. I wrote a monograph putting my thesis together, which did seem to be very unlike anybody else's, but mostly because my background is rather more different, unusual in a way. And I took it to Arizona, because the Arizona Opera were putting on The Ring at the university. And I thought that would be a sensible place to take it. Despite my experience in the Netherlands, I thought, well, you know, America is probably more sensible. It's got its First Amendment and so on and so on. They won't be so intimidated. So I put it on the book table there. It was called, as a monograph, it was called Richard Wagner's Artwork of the Future and Judaism, Inspirational or Conspiratorial? And it had a very nice cover. It had Siegfried lying under the dappled light of a tree, and on the ground was very nice golden light. And I thought, because I'd been to art school for 4 years, I thought, well, I was publishing it myself. I called it my reconnaissance book. So I didn't have white pages. I thought I'd have yellow pages to blend in with this dappled light on the cover. So the opera house soon after, hours after I put my monograph on the university table, they rang me and they said, we're awfully sorry, but we've had a threatening phone call. We've had a complaint about your monograph. And the gentleman has said that he is going to burn down the opera house and he's going to give us a very bad name if your monograph, it's only a very thin little thing, was to remain on the table. Well, extraordinarily enough, they rang me. I don't know why they didn't ring the police. But, you know, for some reason or other, when this man threatens the opera house to burn it down, they ring me. I was beginning to feel like the mafia, you know, how he says, you went to the police, you should have come to me, you know. Well, anyway, they came to me. So I said, look, I'd brought my monograph as a reconnaissance. I wanted to know what people thought of my unusual conclusions, that I hadn't come to cause trouble, that at a university I thought that people would be interested to talk about it. I didn't know that we'd cause any incendiary behavior, and that I insisted that the academics should read it, that I would give them a couple of days. It was quite short. 100 pages, and because I could not allow them to call me anti-Semitic when the very premise of my monograph was opposing the idea of anti-Semitism being the correct term for the problem. So, meantime, there was more drama in the foyer than ever Wagner ever had on his stage, because there was such a performance. The Americans, of course, said, we don't care what that book's about. We got our first, we want it back on the table, and so on and so on. And the poor director didn't know what to do about this, because here was this Benjamin the Bully threatening. Well, he was confused, actually, because this is one thing that I have discovered through this whole decade, is that those who oppose free speech in this and this investigation don't like it when you don't hate. This confuses them, because they do need this. The identity requires envy. It's based upon Judaism, to my way of thinking, is based upon, when you boil it all down, it's based upon an idea of a father or a godfather who favors only one of his children. Now, we know in life that a father who favors only one of his children, no good can come from that. A, you're going to make the favored one narcissistic and deluded, because it's an unreasonable idea for a father to only favor one of his children. We don't regard that as a natural. It's not natural for that. And then, of course, you set up in the siblings a certain rivalry or a certain demoralization, which comes again back to the motivating drive. So I say it is a very unpleasant and very unworkable foundation for a religion. In fact, I don't think Judaism is a religion. I think it's a political organization, and always was, because it's always been involved in matters territorial and material. This is not a spiritual subject. So, in any case, that was my view on Judaism. So I regarded this chap as I said to him, your enemy is not me, your enemy are those Hebrew scriptures, which separate you from what Wagner would call lovelessness. He called Judaism loveless. And I dare say, though he didn't give that explanation that I do, I dare say that's the sort of thing that he meant. That if you're going to create a religion based on an idea that a father only loves one of his children, this is not love. This is a sort of sycophantic kind of an idea, which you could loosely describe as loveless. So Benjamin the Bully was very confused with me, because I didn't answer what he felt that I should hate him. I didn't hate him. He was causing a bit of trouble, but I thought he was embarrassing himself, frankly, and making himself look very silly. So he was, as I say, there was a lot of drama in the foyer, for one thing or another. It was like a boxing match, actually. People just didn't know who was going to hit whom and so on. So in any case, when the book was put back on the table after the people said there's nothing hateful about this book, Benjamin was then very convinced that the first thing he had to do was kill me. I mean, he wasn't sure up until that point, but the moment the matter was lost and the book was going to air, so of course the police had to be called, but I have to say it wasn't for me, it was for him. So, but there was a follow-on from this extraordinarily silly campaign, because years later I was invited by an elderly gentleman, Berlin Jew in his 80s. He had been he wrote these user-friendly, he called them, user-friendly guides to Wagner's operas. And they were very amusing and very, very good. But the thing for Rudolf Sabor, which is his name, was that he thought that Wagner was half-Jewish. So he was deeply enthusiastic about Wagner, but I think probably because of that. Now, of course, I have to tell you that Wolfgang Wagner, who's the elder of the family who looks after Bayreuth, is very adamant that there were no Geyer, who was meant to be the illegal father, was in fact not Jewish. So unfortunately Sabor's view is not substantiated, but nevertheless he was a very amusing man, and he'd written a stage play which he called Wagner, and he had asked me if I would star in it, because he felt that I had an understanding of Wagner that he wouldn't find in other actresses. And he also thought that I would be able to play Wagner's two wives at two different ages in their life, plus the two mistresses. So there were six parts in this stage play, and he had made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I began training for this part, and we'd booked the theatre, a three-week run, and everything was ticking over. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I had a telephone call at my home from Lady Young. She asked me, was I the person who had written this monograph in Arizona? So I said I was. She said, I am the major backer for this stage play. I am withdrawing my funds. I have asked the other five people to withdraw their funds, because we will not support something that you're starring in. So I have to say, that I greatly respect Rudolf Sabor, because he, especially at his age, the opportunities for him to get that play on stage would be pretty slim at his age. And yet he stuck to his, he would not be bullied. And I thought to myself, this is one of the occasions where you realize that quite often in history, people have said, oh, my best friend is Jewish, in order to counter any claims about anti-Semitism. Well, indeed, this is likely to be true, because Jews are just the same as anybody else. They are not different. What is different is the formula of their identity that they like to adopt. That is different. And in fact, I think that the people who wrote those Hebrew scriptures are probably psychopathic. And I say that because I think anybody that would construe a religion based on the principle that I have just expressed, A, is loveless, I think that's the right term for it, and it also involves danger for those who want to follow it and identify with it as Jews, and danger for those who don't, because the behavior and the mission statement is likely to sully the opposite, the non-Jew, into behaving badly, because sibling rivalry is like that. If everybody agrees with this kind of, colludes with this kind of mythadeldom, it is a very ugly scenario, and no good can come from it, no good has come from it. So, now let me think, where was I going there when I went off into a tangent?
How about the stage play?
The stage play, that's right. So yes, and I was saying that, thank you, that I was saying that, so there were repercussions of my little reconnaissance book, and the show was cancelled, and to this day it's never been staged. Now, not too long after that, I happened to read in the Times a quote from David Irving. Now, I'd never heard of David Irving, because I'd never been interested in World War II particularly. I've never read, it's not my sort of area particularly. But he said something interesting. He asked a question that I think is the question that should be asked. He said that if he were a Jew, he would not now ask who pulled the trigger, but why. And I thought that's the right question. Because, after all, you have this idea of a Holocaust with a capital H, which is a biblical term. It's the sacrificial burnt offering. It does imply that someone offered something. Now, I have always wondered who offered this burnt offering in order to call it a Holocaust with a capital H, which Jews do insist this is the right term. It's their choice. Now, it couldn't have been the Germans. They weren't offering a Holocaust burnt offering, if indeed there was any burnt offering at all, but certainly they would not, even so, it would not be appropriate. They cannot be the offerers. It certainly wouldn't be the political prisoners, because given the mission statement of Judaism, Jews, because they insist it's genetic, and only they insist it's genetic, and if we fall for it and become anti-Semitic, we then fall for their advertising completely, is my argument, because they put their babies at risk if they want to insist that Judaism is genetic. So if you want to believe Jews and their leadership, then all of Jewry in Germany and wherever were victims only of their scriptures, not of the Germans, because after all, what is the mission statement of Judaism? We don't need any conspiracy theories when we have their own scriptures. And in Isaiah, as I see their mission statement, is clearly in Isaiah, chapter 66, verse 6, it says, Israel shall enrich itself and boast of itself in the Gentile nations. Now that is a very fifth columnist kind of policy. It is not a religion, it is clearly a political statement, especially if you're going to refer to yourself as the elect. You have elected to carry out this mission, and it's a very material, territorial mission. So that is the mission statement. given that mission statement and given the insistence that Jews want to call any criticism of Judaism anti-Semitic, that is, genetic, one has to wonder, was it reasonable for anyone to consider their activities treacherous? The one characteristic that I think is really universal that all of us cannot stand is treachery. It's the one thing that is truly painful in any relationship. It's the one thing that causes people in their divorce to argue over ridiculous things. Bathroom cupboards and who's going to sort out what. I mean, it really is something that deeply gnaws at us. So if we are thinking in terms and believing that all religions are based upon the same idea, we're going to be in trouble. And I think Wagner was so accurate when he said during the 1850s, when Germany was becoming a nation, he said already that we needed to be emancipated from Jewry rather than allowing them to emancipate into a country he described as not ready. He said that Christianity was not ready. Now, I think that's right, because, now I'm speaking as an atheist, who I will accept is psychologically Christian. But the concept is, in Christianity as I understand it, and the term is that you have sheep. That means you have people who trust that there are no psychopaths in the world, that everyone is redeemable. Now, you have sheep who trust. On the other hand, you have Judaism, which has that of its own. It's not my conspiracy theory. I'm reading from its scriptures. It has very much a fifth columnist concept. So you think of that as a wolf. So if you're going to allow a wolf among the sheep, you're going to get the result that you do get, because people don't understand. They want to trust a religion they've now hyphenated as something that's the same, without understanding that those Ten Commandments and any other thing was never for Jews, for non-Jews. And as somebody rightly pointed out in the film The Schindler's List, that, you know, saving one soul is to save the whole of humanity. But, you know, in Judaism, the only people with a soul are the Jews. So, you know, we are really being misled. And that's why I come back to this contrary-wise Alice in Wonderland world, where we're not really understanding quite the concept. The concept is actually back the front. How am I going for time? I should quickly tell you what happened at the back to Irving's trial, his libel action. Well, I thought I'd go along and hear what he had to say, but I wasn't very hopeful because it had said that he was a Holocaust denier. Now, that suggests to me the sort of thing which would be the equivalent of denying World War II. So it rather suggested, as it should, as it's supposed to, as his intention, the coinage is intended to make a person look very foolish, because it does suggest, you know, denying World War II, because, as we understand it, World War II was entirely about these particular people. Oh, and incidentally, I have to say that when I was doing an MA in Psychology of Religion at London University, I came across, for one of the seminar notes, an article about Kohut, who is a Jewish psychoanalyst who gave a lecture at Berklee College and shocked everybody, because he said he had been a prisoner in these internment camps. And the thing that struck him was not the cruelty of Germans. In fact, he said, by and large, the Germans were not cruel in his experience, which infuriated the audience that happened to be as detailed in this paper. He said, no, the thing that bothered him, which is similar to Benjamin the Bully, is that the Germans didn't appear to hate. They just disregarded these people. They were just political prisoners. They were not special. It seemed to Kohut that the painful thing was not to be regarded as special. You know, and it comes from this identity. If you're going to raise children with the concept that to feel important is to have envy. They do often say that anti-Semitism is a result of envy. They do think that. Well, if you're raised with that idea, you would think that. And I think that's why they don't understand, it would seem, why people dislike their behavior. They do have a difficulty, because if you have this idea of yourself, you can't understand why everybody doesn't think your sensibilities are so vital. Anyway, so I wasn't expecting a lot, but I went along to hear Irving speak, and I was astonished by the quality of his debate. Objective, factual, rational. Sometimes he isn't when he's giving one of these kind of lectures, but in the courtroom, he was amazing, just amazing. So by contrast to the other side of the room, were about 25 people with their laptops, financed by Spielberg, etc., in contact with the Israeli government. I mean, it was as he wanted it to be depicted, and indeed it was. It was David and Goliath, no question about that. So I stayed for the duration of the 2 months. I went every day. And I thought I was there sort of fairly anonymously, but I appeared in the Searchlight magazine, described as the mysterious blonde Fraulein. Well, I have to say, it seems to me that every time I'm sort of described by the press up until fairly recently, it's sort of flattering, really, because I think you have to be 15 to be a Fraulein. So but they did also begin the lies that really culminated extremely well when I attended one of Mark's conferences. I'm afraid when I took Irving to the Reform Club and he got banned just for breathing in and out, he thanked me for exposing him to the first time he'd ever been banned from a club. And I'm afraid it's the same for Mr. Weber, that I come along to his conference in good faith, and next minute there's a 4-page article which begins by describing the Nazi knitting grannies in the front row. So I would like you to know that if Mr. Johann Harry were here again at an IHR conference, he would be describing, as we see now, loads of Nazi knitting grannies in the front row. At the end of this 4-page article in The Independent on Sunday, because I'm skipping quite a bit now because I see I'm running out of time, if you saw the last sentence, you would laugh. But if you read the whole 4 pages and get to the last sentence, it makes complete sense. Well, I'll just give you a quick idea of this 4-page article, which is called "The Lady's Not for Turning." But it doesn't say why she's not for turning, because it was undoubtedly commissioned 11 months after the conference. This article appears. You know, it's not news if it's 11 months after the conference, but it's in perfect timing to get rid of me from this particular club. And I should tell you that the Reform Club is a former gentleman's club built on the lines of Farnese's palace in Italy, designed by the man Charles Barry, who designed the House of Parliament. It's a very beautiful building, and I happened to take Irving along there, to cut a long story short, because I thought it was wrong that he was being pariahed. But though he did nothing, he came, ate his dinner, listened to the speaker, and left. The following day, people said, had they been in the club house, though they weren't, their sensibilities would have been hurt, and the club was duly forced to ban Irving from ever coming to the club again, though he broke no rules and did nothing at all. And after that, for 3 years, they tried to get rid of me because I simply wouldn't apologize for doing that. So that's how this article about the IHR happened to be commissioned, in order to get 66 people to sign a requisition for my expulsion from the club. And 66 people signed it, though they'd never met me, but they had agreed that my presence in the club was keeping them from coming to the club, because they regarded me as repugnant. And they were being advised that though I may seem charming, in fact I'm sinister. Though I don't hate, though there are no witnesses to my hating, there is no evidence, there's nothing to prove either any substantiation of hatred. Nevertheless, one should never be without the idea that I am sinister and repugnant. So it's quite a story about that, but just to quickly tell you about this article, because it's fairly amusing. In the middle of the article, fabrications, things that events that never happened, quotes that I never said, said that I look, because it'll make you feel akin to this experience, because you're sitting in the audience on this occasion. It said that I look marginally less ridiculous than had just been previously described about my rising topless out of an oyster shell in a television commercial. So he was saying I looked marginally less ridiculous, though of course he was describing something that had never happened. So it was pretty libelous and pretty slanderous, because how does he know? And after all, that's my career. So there I was, looking marginally less ridiculous, when I screeched from the audience, "Heathen Jews." Now, I've already told you that I'm an atheist, so it is quite impossible for me to screech "heathen Jews." Of course, Jews can perfectly well describe me as heathen. So I took my complaint about this to the Press Complaints Commission, because I thought I was on a fairly clean, steady place here. Here he was describing my acting in a commercial in which I had never appeared topless nor rose out of an oyster shell, and that I could not possibly be quoted as saying what he said. Mr. Weber had said that there's no way I had interrupted speakers. Yet the Press Complaints Commission said, well, they sent, the Independent on Sunday sent 200 pages in response. They said that I echoed everybody from Le Pen to, well, there wasn't any revisionist. It was fascinating, really. I had no idea how many revisionists there were. It was, and I echoed all of them, apparently, though I'd hardly heard of any of them. So I thought I was on a pretty clean thing with the PCC, that they would have to declare that this man had invented, and there should be a correction in the paper. No. They said, given what I do say, that his impression was reasonable. So even the press complaints, we know the newspapers, that was the article that started the problem with the Evening Standard, because it was about an email that somebody had sent me about Jewish control of the British media. And it was very accurate, I thought, but I had sent it to several people to check if, in fact, it was somebody had tipped off the newspaper and they had wronged me. But I have to say, this man actually quoted very clearly and well from the piece and quoted me correctly, except that he never said I was anti-Semitic. He said the email was anti-Semitic. And how he got this very accurate piece into the press is because it rode in on the strength of a very silly way of describing me. It was quite slanderous in the way that it described me. So I quite often say that my father's side of the family came to England in 1066 with the William the Conqueror, and the motto of the family is an ass's head. And the idea is that the man would ride back into battle on the back of an ass, if a horse couldn't be found. So I say, so long as I can ride back into battle on the back of an ass of a storyline, fine, if it gets the right message out, which it did. But I regret to say, I think that will be that's a short-lived thing now, because they did not, the paper, once it realized that it was very effective, this piece, it didn't have the effect that it was. It's been counterbalanced. But anyway, I'm sure I've gone on too long. But it's fascinating how we find that even the Press Complaints Commission is not reliable. So I think, to conclude, the way to go, and I think there's a very positive way to go, is that in Britain now we are starting what is called the battle for Britain. That's the little flyer. And we call ourselves the Defenders of the Realm. Now, we are trying to prevent the EU, the European Union Constitution, taking supremacy over our British Constitution. I know a lot of people say that the British don't have a constitution. Well, actually, they do. They have the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights. They have many documents, including their institutions. In any case, the seniors of the Commonwealth, which I would describe Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and America, they have their constitutions based on the mother country's ideas. And so I would like to see all of us try to defend our constitutions, which it seems to me that is the cleanest way to go. We have these substantial documents which we are perfectly entitled to fight for. After all, people have fought for us. This is something that is rock bottom sound, and I call it Hellenic based, skeptical based thinking rather than Judaic based thinking, which is now what is overcoming us, and even our basic constitution is being overwhelmed by Judaic law. So I'm hoping before June, when I go back to England after this trip, to prevent this from happening. In June, it's possible that we may actually have our sovereignty taken away. It's been taken away little by little since the war, but this is a major move. And we have, unlike the Americans actually, Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders do have this additional bow to our democracy. Because if we're not happy with our politicians and our government, and heavens knows how many millions of people have marched around the world, you can see the vast difference between what people think and what their governments want to do. We have this other string to the bow, where we can ask the Queen to withhold her royal assent. Now, that's not to make her political, because she is below the law too. The law is above everybody. But it does mean that she, in doing that, can stop any bill from going through until the people have gotten their national referendum, because that's what they want. And in this way, if we can do that, many things will come of it. Many questions will come out. You know, in the CNN and so on, they all say we analyze the news. Well, of course, they don't analyze the news. They give us fairy tales. But in this, it would have to be an analysis of so many things. And out of this, I believe, would come many subjects, including the one that we're currently addressing. And so I think this is an extremely valuable way of going. And that's what I hope to see. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention.